This is Functional Medicine Update for April 2001, Volume 21, Number 4. In this issue, we will consider the functional aspects of women's health. Our interview will be with Dr. Bethany M. Hayes, discussing estrogen balance and perimenopause. We'll begin our report with a look at the power of memes, followed by genomic medicine and the individual patient, and then our clinician interview. On side two of this tape, we will include features on hot flashes, DHEA supplementation, the use of progesterone and estrogen in concert, and several important items, all dealing with issues of hormone balancing. Now here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland in the April 2001 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
We have been talking over the last several months about the changing architecture and climate surrounding this new emergent medical paradigm. Remember the PricewaterhouseCoopers 2010 HealthCast report talked about how the healthcare system will change over the first decade of the 21st century through the three forces of change, which are consumer activism, the e-health commerce information and the web, and genomics, personalized medicine arising out of it, and how that will change the way that we study various kinds of medical issues from a clinical and research perspective, and how that translates into, quote, proof of efficacy and safety for new therapies. Well, this theme is certainly mirrored recently in this interesting dialogue and debate that's concerning clinical studies. Is the double-blind placebo-controlled trial the gold standard for all questions that we want to ask and have answered in the area of intervention, patient outcome, and new potential modalities for therapy? Well, that is a question that has now moved its way up to the review at national governmental levels, looking at the Helsinki's new clinical rules for evaluating studies with human subjects that would be ethically and morally correct. You know, the double-blind placebo-controlled trial assumes that one group is not going to do as well, potentially, as another group, and it raises some real ethical considerations. If you put one group on a substance that does not prove to be as efficacious, so-called placebo, as the verum group, or maybe even the placebo itself is more successful than the treatment group, the verum group, one asks the question, how long do you have to continue out the clinical trial before you discontinue and put the group at risk out of the risk category? And often the statistical analysis of the studies would have to be carried on longer than might be considered ethically justifiable for the risk to the individuals participating in that study. So this has been a reasonably intense discussion about how should we view studies in the future. In a recent issue of Science Magazine, Volume 290, page 418, the title of this paper on page 418 in the year 2000 was Helsinki's New Clinical Rules, Fewer Placebos, More Disclosure. Well, clearly that's signaling that there may be very vast changes in the way that we assume how to prove the efficacy and safety of new substances. The risks and benefits, burdens, and effectiveness of new methods should be tested against those of the best current prophylactic, diagnostic, and therapeutic methods according to the new Declaration of Helsinki approved October 2000. We should be less involved then with placebos against something that may put patients at risk. That's a very interesting philosophical change because, as you know, often nutritional or functional medicine interventions that are multivariate in their particular approach have been criticized because they haven't been subjected to randomized, placebo-controlled, clinical, double-blinded trials. And now we're starting to say that these types of trials across the board may be under scrutiny and that the benefit-risk analysis and burdens and effectiveness of new methods should be tested against the best available approaches, which means comparison studies. This could open up for limited clinical trials. This could look for case-controlled studies and other ways, including pattern recognition, complex data set analysis, and cluster analysis, to give rise to new ways of describing proof of efficacy. I think that we're seeing across the board interesting changes in the way that we even address hypotheses and how those hypotheses are answered in medicine, which clearly opens up new opportunities to look at function rather than just at pathology, because function and the answer to it may be locked in these web-like interactions of complex variable and data sets that require more than single agent for single outcome type approaches and are more amenable then to comparison studies and cluster analysis type multivariate analysis. We're really changing, aren't we, not our genes in the way we look at medicine. We're changing our memes, the memory power, the transferred memory aspects of a culture which is in its rich history, its written history, its oral history. I think the book, The Selfish Gene, by Dawkins a number of years ago, got us thinking that the gene is a selfish replicator. It just only cares about replicating itself, and the organism that carries the gene is only just the receptacle in which the gene is able to do its work, which is to replicate itself. And it sounded as if we as a human were just being carried along by these selfish genes. However, in the last chapter of that same book, Dawkins opened up what may be the most enduring part of this book, the question as to whether the genes were only part of the story. In fact, the genes change very slowly over millennia of evolution, whereas possibly the memory-transferred learned behaviors that he called memes, M-E-M-E-S, are more important in transferring survivability of the culture to its future. And it's these behaviors and ideas that are copied from person to person by imitation, these so-called memes, that have forced the human genes to make us what we are today. A very powerful concept, and in fact, described beautifully in a recent issue of Scientific American, volume 283, page 64, in which memes may be the most powerful driving forces in creating new cultural approaches to problem solving. And that is, of course, what we're trying to establish in Functional Medicine Update, is new memes, new perspectives, new approaches, new views, new ways of looking at problems so that they can be solved and then culturally transmitted to the next generation without having to wait for the long, arduous process of natural selection that occurs through genetic modification. So memes can change quickly, genes change slowly, and memes can have a very competitive advantage, obviously, in allowing a culture to survive, particularly in a rapidly changing environment. And certainly, if there's anything we can say about 21st century living is that we're in a rapidly changing environment. And I'm not just speaking here strictly about the medical environment, the HealthCast 2010 report. I'm talking about the overall cultural environment in which we live, in which its memes of the culture may determine its longevity and its effect to posterity. One of those major memes that's changing is this third force of change called genomics, functional genomics. Genomic medicine and the individual patient, Bite to Bedside, B-Y-T-E to Bedside, is a recent article title in the Journal of the American Medical Association, volume 284, on page 2642. We are, for the first time, according to the authors, Dr. Catherine DeAngelis, Roger Rosenberg, and Jeanette Smith, starting to witness the change in the way the doctor will talk to his or her patient related to their specific signs and symptoms and health problems of the moment and their longer-term health management programs. This moves us away from, as they say, diagnostic testing, looking for the presence of pathology, to prognostic or medical thinking, a different mean that looks like the future might be part of the patient's overall program. Where are they going? What's the trajectory of the way their genes are being expressed that give rise to either function or dysfunction? And I think that's a beautiful example of what Dr. Peter Kohler from the Oregon Health Sciences University has recently talked about in his article, From Theory to Practice in the Genomics Area. He talks about the fact that 25 years ago, few of medical practitioners imagined owning a computer that they would carry in their briefcase. And now, as a consequence of the rapid rise of informatics and information technology, we have access to the world's data bank in real time, and that the Human Genome Project simultaneously is opening up the discovery of the book of life, the 23 chapters that make up our genetic inheritance. And what we're learning from that is not just how we will die, it's not rigidly determined, but rather how we will live, what the various permutations and combinations of our genes that weave themselves together to give rise to the interaction with our environment may be to create the opportunity for a long, healthy life of 9, 10, or more decades. That's a very profoundly different model of medicine than that which we have viewed in the past, which is deterministically thought of as relates to the locking of sperm with egg to give rise to a set characteristic called our genome that we cannot do anything about. It's the expression of our genes that really determine our health in midlife thereon, and our expression of genes are modified by our environment. That's what Dr. Kohler speaks to, and therefore doctors will be counseling their patients about functional genomics. And in fact, recently a report is that Motorola is now developing a home diagnostic test using a handheld device for DNA evaluation, DNA genomics. I mean, where is this world going? Where will we be in the year 2020 with regard to the accessibility of our own unique genetic information and how our environment modulates it? Well, there's no more interesting area right now in application of this concept than that of hormone balance, particularly the neuroendocrine balance in women, which is the focus of this month's Functional Medicine Update. Our clinician of the month this month is an expert in guiding us to think through this web of interacting variables that are coded for in our genes, that are modified in their expression by our environment, nutrition, lifestyle, stress, toxins, and so forth, and how that then expresses itself finally as either what we might call a healthy, low morbid aging process or an aging process with higher morbidity. And it's with that theme in mind that I'd like to turn to our this month's Clinician of the Month, Dr. Bethany Hayes.
We're very pleased the month before our international symposium here in April of 2001 to have a Clinician of the Month who's going to speak to us on the topic really that relates to our symposium, functional endocrinology. And actually, she is one of our keynote presenters for our upcoming 8th International Symposium in Vancouver, British Columbia. And by the way, I'm supposed to remind you because I made a mistake on one of the previous tapes. I mean, how would I ever do that? I certainly never make any mistakes, right? I gave you some missed dates in our previous edition, so that those of you that might have waited to the last minute to register for the symposium, let me give you the right date. It's May 22nd through 26th, 2001 at the Weston Bay Shore in Vancouver, British Columbia. And the program, if you haven't received it already, which you probably have, but if you haven't, please just give us a call at our 800 number and we'll get you fixed up with the information you need. And you'll note when you examine the program that one of our keynote presenters for our symposium is Dr. Bethany Montgomery Hayes, who is our Clinician of the Month this month. So let me just give you a quick little thumbnail about Bethany. Educated at Wellesley and Baylor College of Medicine, board certified in obstetrics and gynecology, was an assistant professor of OBGYN at Baylor for a number of years, been in private practice in different clinical settings, still remains as a clinical associate professor of medicine at University of Vermont, actively involved as a faculty in our Institute for Functional Medicine program, working very extensively with the American Holistic Medical Association, and having a very wide outreach in her clinical situation, now working in the women-to-women clinic in Yarmouth, Maine, along with Dr. Christian Northrup, who has been a previous Clinician of the Month in Functional Medicine Update. And Dr. Hayes has taken on the responsibility, which is a formidable task in our Applied Functional Medicine and Clinical Practice Training Program, to take on the female endocrine system discussions. As you know, this can be one of the most complex web-like conundrums to try to distill down to understanding. And Bethany has done just a magnificent job in doing that, highly acclaimed in our program. So, with great fanfare and real pleasure, Dr. Hayes, I want to welcome you to Functional Medicine Update.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm honored to be asked to do this.
I thought we might start with the whole discussion of perimenopause and then maybe move from that into a discussion of menopause and how you view some of the things that are in the medical news right now as it relates to the modulation of hormone imbalances that occur throughout perimenopause and menopause, knowing that there's a lot of different stuff floating in the wind. In fact, just this last weekend, I was visiting Boston and Chicago and Seattle, talking with doctors, and had a number of compounding pharmacists come up to me and talk to me about all these various hormonal mixtures that they're putting together to ameliorate the symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. So clearly this is a big area for medical consumer interest and also practitioner interest. Let's start with perimenopause. You know, I think there's this view that is, you know, is almost one of the fundamental paradigms in endocrinology, at least women's health-related endocrinology, that when a woman starts showing in her perimenopausal period the symptoms of flushing and vasomotor-related dysfunctions that seem to precede the onset of menopause, that this is a sign of estrogen deficiency, because certainly when estrogen is administered to that woman, her symptoms go away. So it's been jumped to the conclusion that it must be estrogen deficiency. And I recall, as you talked to us at our Applied Functional Medicine training program, that the story is a little bit more complex about that, and the estrogen connection to vasomotor symptoms and how that interrelates with proper management in light of new information needs some inquiry. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about that emerging story.
Well, the situation in terms of estrogen in the perimenopause, and I guess we should start by defining perimenopause because there are a lot of definitions floating around out there. The World Health Organization defines perimenopause as the time from which abnormalities associated with hormone changes begin to occur to 1 year after the last menstrual period. I think that's an interesting definition because I really believe that the heart of the issue for women's hormones at midlife centers around the fluctuating levels of hormones that begin in a woman's usually 40s, if you use 52 as the peak time for menopause to occur, and probably go on for several years after menopause. And it's these fluctuating levels, where the levels of hormones are sometimes high and sometimes low, that produce a lot of the problems. In a review article that Jerry Lynn Pryor wrote, she went back and looked at basically all of the studies where they had measured hormone levels in the perimenopause. I think it's an exquisite article. And what she discovered was that long ago, before this idea that hot flashes mean low estrogen came about, they had actually measured hormone levels in the perimenopause and found the estrogen levels were elevated. And then she went back and reviewed sort of the raw data and found that, in fact, in the perimenopause, until very soon before the last period, and even for a while afterward, there are fluctuations above the normal level of estrogen, that estrogen levels overall, the area under the curve, is elevated and not depressed. And that makes perfect sense when you're a clinician looking at the women coming into your office. Because what are they complaining about? They're complaining about heavy periods. They're complaining about fibroid growth. They're complaining about endometriosis. They're complaining about breast tenderness. Those are all symptoms of high estrogen, not low estrogen. Then they tell you about their hot flashes. And you get confused because, wait a minute, everybody says hot flashes are from low estrogen, and certainly we treat hot flashes with estrogen. So what's going on? Well, in this article, she points out that probably hot flashes are related to changes in estrogen level. So I think the hot flash issue has led us as clinicians astray for quite a while. And the real importance of perimenopause is this elevated estrogen, because it produces the symptoms that lead women to situations like hysterectomy and maybe breast cancer and endometrial cancer. So I think that's where the real heart of the matter is in the menopausal transition. By the time you get through this fluctuating hormone level, a lot of the problems have straightened out.
That is really fascinating, because I think that so many times we in Western medicine are taught that good medicine is doing something. It's not necessarily being, it's doing, and therefore this demand to intervene and to give something. So here we have a symptom, vasomotor reactivity, it's producing adverse response, the quality of life is diminished, so we need to do something, which is to jump in and rescue by giving hormone. And I think the assumption was that we were treating the estrogen deficiency, so the treatment was related to the cause. But now you're telling us that from Jerry Lynn Pryor's work, and actually thanks to some of the things you shared with me, it goes back into the 80s. I recall there's a paper that talks about this estrogen supraphysiological levels associated with perimenopause. So how does that lead the clinician then into managing? Do you just do watchful waiting, or do you...
Well, no, I think it leads you to two possibilities. The second part of perimenopause that we haven't really discussed is the balancing hormone for estrogen in women is progesterone. We know that because progesterone down-regulates estrogen receptors and has a number of other activities that modulate estrogen function and make it safe to have all of this growth-producing hormone around. In perimenopause, and every fertility specialist in the world knows this because they always put their 40-year-old and older women on progesterone, the progesterone production decreases. So what you really have in perimenopause is an increase in estrogen but a decrease in progesterone. That leads you to a couple of things. Number one, this idea of, oh, a woman has hot flashes so we should give her estrogen. I can't tell you how many women I've seen who are estrogen toxic because they were treating their symptoms with more and more and more estrogen. In fact, what you want to do is modulate the swings in estrogen. So you want to try to lower the peaks and raise the troughs so that the swing is not so fast and furious and doesn't produce the symptoms. And these are serious symptoms. The symptom of hot flashes that leads to sleep disturbance, that leads to irritability and depression, that leads women to come into your office and say, I'm falling apart here. I can't do my job. I can't take care of my family. I'm a mess. Do something. Is, I think, a really important symptom that we need to address and not just ignore. So my approach is to address the modulation by using the things that we know that affect estrogen metabolism in terms of down-regulating the overall estrogen effect at the cellular level, and then substitute phytoestrogens, for instance, for the troughs, the low parts of the estrogen swings, and then add progesterone in so that you balance the amount of estrogen with a progestogen that keeps the overgrowth situations from occurring.
Well, that's a wonderful, obviously we've got a lot of questions to ask to follow up from that kind of design. Before we jump to the therapeutic part of this, I guess we first need to ask questions related to the assessment side of it, because a lot of clinicians will say, well, if I'm going to do this kind of assistance of helping the woman to find this rhythmic dance of hormones during this perimenopausal period, do I need to do certain kinds of testing? Do I need to measure plasma? Do I need to measure urinary metabolites? Do I need to measure salivary levels? What's your thought about the evaluation of hormones? Is it more clinically focused, or is it a combination of lab plus clinical to make these assessments?
Well, because the levels of hormones are fluctuating so dramatically during this period, any single level of either salivary or serum hormone can be anywhere. It can be all over the map. You can get high, you can get normal, you can get low. I know there are a lot of people who believe in doing salivary hormone levels as a way of looking at where you are in the picture and what to do therapeutically, but I found them uniquely unhelpful. I use salivary hormone levels more to determine what effect I've had with my therapeutics than I do to determine where in the situation the woman is and how to start a therapeutic regimen. So I tend to use clinical signs to tell me whether the dominant situation is high or low estrogen. The clinical situation that correlates with high estrogen is breast tenderness, or the most sort of finely tuned piece, I think, is breast tenderness. And the symptoms of low estrogen, probably the only short-term clinical symptom is hot flashes, which don't necessarily mean you have low estrogens, but mean that you have falling estrogens. So if I have people with breast tenderness, I assume that their overall estrogen situation is high. And if I have people having increasing numbers of hot flashes, then I may look at how many times out of the month they're in a low estrogen environment. Long term, you can look at things like vaginal epithelium and skin and hair changes, cardiovascular disease, effect on lipid levels, things like that. I basically go with the clinical information before I investigate the laboratory.
In the article that you referred to, the very excellent review article by Jerry Lynn Pryor, and by the way, for those of you that are kind of following references, you'll find this in the summary card at the end of this month, but it's in Endocrine Reviews in 1998. She talks about the fact that in different cultures, there are very different prevalences of these, at least the report of these vasomotor symptomatologies at perimenopause / menopause, and raises the question from other people's works as to whether the difference in reporting that women have is a consequence of them being more stoic about it, or whether there's really a difference in the frequency based upon their gene-environment interaction. Do you have any thoughts about the prevalency of that condition in the United States versus other countries? Is it just the way women approach these things, or is there actually a difference based on lifestyle, you think, in the appearance of these flushing syndromes?
Well, the functional medicine answer to that is it's more complex. Certainly dietary issues come into play. If you have a diet that is rich in B vitamins and soy products, you're going to metabolize your estrogens differently. Another issue that may come into play is the effect of the adrenal stress profile on those changes and how estrogens interact with that profile. In countries where there's been an overuse of antibiotics and there's a lot of overgrowth of yeast in the GI tract, you're going to have higher levels of estrogen related to mycoestrogens from the yeast in the gut. So I think it's simplistic to think that it's simply women in other cultures are more stoic. They may actually have less swinging around of their hormone levels than women in this culture do.
You raised another very interesting point. Now we're moving in a transition from assessment and understanding to management, and that was reference to the B vitamin status. And I find this really a fascinating chapter. I was reminded of a paper I think I saw a number of years ago that was actually referenced by Carlton Fredericks in his best-selling book back in the 1970s about nutrition and breast cancer risk. in which he talked about Morton Biskin and his work as an endocrinologist at Beth Israel Hospital in New York back in the 30s, and I actually found a paper in 1938 about the role that, from his studies in female animals, B vitamins had in estrogen passage through the liver. The detoxification mechanisms for estrogen were not discovered until after 1971, so this was a lot of years before we really knew how things were detoxified, but it was known that the liver played a role somehow in removing or modifying estrogen passage. Could you tell us a little bit about your view of the B vitamin family and this estrogen modulation, knowing there are many women who are probably subclinically deficient or insufficient with B vitamins?
Well, I think it's an interesting area, interesting partly because, as you say, there was some really good information back before the 70s and then just got left behind. I don't even know why. It may have to do with the prejudice against anything nutritional in our medical radar screen. It just fell off the radar screen. But I think it's really important. There is some pretty reasonable evidence that B vitamins are involved in liver metabolism of estrogen. And so that's one of the areas that I look at to try to modulate estrogen levels. There's some pretty good data about B vitamins and premenstrual syndrome, which is also a situation of elevated estrogen and depressed progesterone sometimes. So I think there is enough information in the literature, and when you add that to the information from, say, the Nurses' Health study that says you take a multivitamin and you decrease your risk of cardiovascular disease by a quarter of the total risk, you really almost can't avoid recommending a good multivitamin with a B complex.
Well, one of the papers that you shared with me is by Biskin in a collaborative study on the nutritional insufficiency and the etiology of menorrhagia and cystic mastitis and PMT. They cited some interesting work, which I was unaware of until I went back and reviewed my biochemistry, on the fact that B's vitamin insufficiency in female animals reduces the ability for estrogen to be detoxified but does not have an effect upon the detoxification of androgens.
That's right.
And so you get this interesting differential effect. I actually think I have a biochemical explanation for that. It relates to flavin adenine nucleotides, which are very important in the detoxification of estrogen, because when you oxidize an estrogen to its metabolite, you have to have something that the electrons are transferred to, which turns out to be FAD. So if you're riboflavin insufficient, you don't have the appropriate electron receptor, so you can't do an oxidation without doing a reduction, where that doesn't pertain to the effects that are found with conversion of the androgens to estrogens. So you can end up getting into a hyperandrogenic state by B vitamin insufficiency.
Well, I think that's perfectly logical. And then the secondary effect of that is the elevated androgens depress sex hormone binding globulin, and then the amount of free estrogen goes even higher. So you really have a snowball effect.
You said it correctly, by the way, and I just said it incorrectly. I meant a hypoandrogenic, hyperestrogenic, and you said it very gracefully the correct way, that you had an underconversion of estrogen and you continue to have the normal conversion of androgen. So differential effects by B vitamin insufficiency, that the outcome then, it looks like the person has too much estrogen because they can't process it correctly to the oxidized derivatives.
Right, but since most of the serum assays for estrogen are bound and unbound, you wouldn't pick up the added effect of the elevated androgens.
Yes, which then leads me to the next area of that very complicated discussion. I think a lot of clinicians forget about the way that sex hormone binding globulin plays a role and that that's also modifiable by stress and diet and lifestyle. Could you tell us a little bit about that issue of the available versus the unavailable forms of estrogens and androgens?
Well, sex hormone binding globulin is affected by a number of steroid hormones as well as being affected by insulin. So this brings in another one of the web factors, the glycemic control, and insulin-resistant folks. And sex hormone binding globulin is just one of a list of, I think I've got 24 things on my list now, that affect estrogen effect at the cellular level. You know, I really want to emphasize that the amount of estrogen in the system doesn't tell you about the estrogen effect in the cell. What's causing the problems for women is the estrogen effect in the cell. So you can get an estrogen effect in the cell, or you can get a mitogenic effect in the cell, for instance, with elevated insulin levels.
That
is more than one pathway that happens. It's really complex, Jeff. I had no idea when I started studying this how complex it was going to end up being.
Well, I think what you're saying there is extraordinarily important for the clinician, because I recall a paper in which they showed that in women with breast cancer, that when they did analysis of breast tissue E2 levels, estradiol levels, that they found that the levels in the breast tissue was 10 to 50 times higher than that it was in the plasma. And, of course, it's the drive that occurs within tissues that's the most important, as you're pointing out, not how much is floating around in the extracellular space. So what they pointed out is that due to localized production, that could be through aromatase in adipose tissue in the breast, that there may be a much higher production not only of estradiol, but the metabolites, like the 2,4, and 16 hydroxylated compounds, which are, at least in the case of the 4 and 16, maybe more genotoxic than estradiol itself. So I think what you're really getting us to understand is that don't jump to very simple-minded decisions on the basis of what's seen floating around in the plasma.
Well, I think that's correct. And then I've been reading recently about progesterone's effect on breast tissue. And it turns out progesterone primes the breast tissue cells for crosstalk with paracrine factors. For instance, progesterone increases the number of insulin receptors in breast tissue. And I think that might have a critical implication when you're giving progesterone, for instance, even natural progesterone, which doesn't seem to have nearly as strong an effect as the artificial progestin, but still has this effect. When you give natural progesterone to someone with insulin resistance and high levels of insulin, you may be putting them at risk instead of decreasing their risk related to the effect of progesterone on apoptosis and estrogen receptors. There's a lot of information that we're still lacking, I think. And it's a little scary to me that there's been this 50-year uncontrolled experiment on women's bodies of giving people hormone replacement therapy.
You just said something there, again, I want to make sure everyone caught, because that is a very, very powerful potential clinical insight. If 20% of the non-diabetic population, as Reeven says, is suffering from some form of insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, and if obviously many of these are women, more than 50% of them are women, then if you start administering androgenic-like hormones, including DHEA, testosterone, and or progesterone, it is possible to produce an untoward effect rather than a favorable effect from those androgenic substances. And I think that's a very important clinical insight. Watchword is look at where the patient is on insulin sensitivity before you start administering androgenic substances.
And I think that's an important reason why the information about hormone replacement therapy, meaning estrogen and progestin, as compared to estrogen alone, may actually be more dangerous for breast tissue. It explains some of the confusion that we see about why progesterone, which downregulates estrogen receptors and creates apoptosis, may have a different effect, but the different effect is only in some women. There's a slide I remember showing at the AFMCP where you looked at luteal phase levels, and there were groups of people who did the opposite from the majority of people. So when we say that progesterone downregulates and produces a certain effect, there was a group of women who went the other direction. And those may have been the women with elevated insulin levels.
That has really come through to me very, very strongly. Thanks to your education, it was like a very strong light went on. And having you share this article in Molecular Endocrinology by Lang, Richer, and Horowitz, which I think is a very powerful discussion about progesterone priming breast cancer cells for crosstalk, and the concept that progestins may in fact decrease expression of the P53 tumor suppressor gene when given at high dose single pulse, then we get into the question of at what dose, of what type, and at what length of therapy, because it appears as if there's a real difference between single dose high potency and maybe progestogens versus progesterone, and how that may then be translated into a physiological message in the woman.
I think that's true. I'm beginning to think the factors that are important in terms of determining the clinical approach to hormone replacement therapy, and I guess I would say you're not replacing hormones if you're giving Premarin and Provera, you're substituting hormones. So I am really actually referring to replacement of estradiol and natural progesterone. But I think the effects that you're going to need to consider are the effect of continuous progesterone is different than the effect of intermittent progesterone, so 2 weeks out of the month progesterone. And I think that the amount of estrogen that you're dealing with is going to have a significant effect on whether you should cycle or give progesterone continuously. And then I think the third piece that's going to be really important is this priming for crosstalk with insulin and insulin-like growth factor, glycemic control, and looking at glucose metabolism is going to be really important.
Let me, if I can, move over to some landmark studies that were done, at least preliminary studies by Guy Abraham that he published over a number of years, and I know you're very familiar with his work and probably know him personally, and he talked about the important role that magnesium has along with calcium in postmenopausal women for the maintenance of bone integrity, and that magnesium he felt was an underappreciated nutrient and also has effects upon hormone balance, and that in conjunction with vitamin B6 and the other B vitamins may be very important in promoting salutary effects on menopause. What's your thought about the Dr. Abraham concepts?
Well, I think he's got a lot of the pieces nailed down absolutely correctly. And I do worry, as do I think a number of the people who considered this issue when the recommendations came out to put women on high doses of calcium, I do worry about people not having enough magnesium. It's one of the superstar supplements, the ones that you can pretty much guarantee you can give to anybody and they're going to get a positive effect because so many people are deficient. Magnesium is important for bone metabolism. I haven't studied the biochemistry well enough. I'm working on that. But I think it is important, and I think anybody that prescribes calcium without also prescribing magnesium may be doing harm instead of good.
I know in one of Dr. Abraham's studies, as I recall back in the 80s, he showed that increased magnesium intake was associated with decreasing estradiol and increasing progesterone levels in patients that had estrogen-progesterone imbalances, indicating that it had a kind of a normalizing effect in the metabolism of those hormones.
I think that's really fascinating, too, and I don't know the biochemistry. Do you?
Well, he made some speculation within his papers as to how he thought it affected various aspects of Krebs cycle function and cell signaling. I think maybe in light of year 2001, some of those concepts might have to go back and be reevaluated. So certainly the clinical evidence seems pretty strong. Let me, if I can, go to the other area that a lot of people are asking about, and that is when, if ever, then given these imbalances that might appear throughout the menopausal transition, would a woman be considered for DHEA supplementation? And I know there's, over the last few years, been a number of at least preliminary clinical trials published on DHEA and various types of things, including depressive disorders and insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, and obesity, and in areas related to hormone imbalances, particularly androgen decreases with low sense of well-being and an altered libido. What's your feeling about DHEA, and if so, where might it be employed?
Well, I think falling levels of DHEA may be highly important in terms of the perimenopausal bone loss. I'm sort of looking at DHEA as a key to getting bone building activity going as opposed to stopping bone reabsorption. So I think that's an interesting area to look at. This is actually a place where I would use salivary hormone levels to assess what I'm doing and whether I'm doing what I think I am. If I give DHEA, and the situation I usually use DHEA is a person with fatigue who has an adrenal stress index that shows low DHEA levels and possibly low cortisol levels as well, I will do a salivary estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, and then start the DHEA. Then after they've been on the DHEA for a while, I'll reassess the estrogens and progestins and testosterone to see where that DHEA is going. Although we tend to think of it in a linear fashion, you know, we always draw those graphs on the board about cholesterol goes to this, goes to progesterone, goes to this, goes to estrogen. In fact, they all exist together in a soup. And the question is, when you throw extra amounts of one chemical in, how do you change the soup? So if you repeat your salivary hormone levels and find out that your DHEA is all being plugged down into estrogen, you better be careful about that. If it's going to cortisol, you may be getting the effect you're looking for.
Very, very interesting. Well, we've just about, I know, expanded the time. Let me, if I can, kind of close with a question which is probably on a lot of individuals' minds, maybe particularly men who don't actually live through in their own bodies the perimenopause and therefore live through it vicariously or through their patients and their experiences. And that is, there is a suggestion that this period from perimenopause into menopause is associated with increasing risk to breast cancer, and those are related to differing cell cycling events where cells have more mitogenic drive and therefore they start to have atypia and certain genes get up or down regulated during that period. And therefore there's this concept that maybe menopause is an unhealthy event and it's dangerous and something we need to fight against. It's not associated with good health. Yet there are reports in the literature that indicate that menopause is just a natural rhythm of life. It can be gone through without compromise of health. What happens with an unnatural menopause is that you get into these imbalances that is associated with unhealth, and maybe we force the equation in our Western world over into the unhealthy part of this rather than the natural healthy menopause. Could you give some comments about that as to whether menopause is a disease as such? We often want to medically taxonomize everything.
Well, there is a lot of information that suggests that menopause is healthy. It's perimenopause that gets everything out of whack. So, for instance, with breast cancer, we know that most breast cancers are very slow growing. So the breast cancer that you discover postmenopause in your 50s or maybe even 60s may have been initiated in perimenopause. And that would make perfect sense if you're looking at the increased stimulation of breast tissue by an elevated estrogen and the failure of apoptosis created by decreased progesterone. The areas that I'm the most interested in looking at in terms of that, how our culture imbalances this program. I mean, I don't think normal perimenopause was supposed to be such a big deal. I think it's gotten to be a big deal primarily because of nutritional changes that are influencing estrogen metabolism and possibly gut-associated problems that are related to the overuse of antibiotics, and add to that the bad food. So I think if you get people invested in being healthy during the perimenopause, menopause is just, I don't have to have periods anymore. That's great.
That's a wonderful place for us to probably finish this discussion, knowing that you've got, I'm sure, most of our listeners sitting on the edge of their seat wanting more answers, wanting to ask questions. And I guess that's what the 8th International Symposium on Functional Medicine is all about, the chance for you and your colleagues who will be on the speaker's roster and on the workshops to have more opportunity to address these questions. So again, I want for our listeners to remind them the 8th International Symposium in Vancouver is on functional medicine approaches to endocrine disturbances associated with aging. And Dr. Hayes, we'll look forward to being with you in May, and just thank you so much for spending the time with us today. I think you've opened our minds and eyes to a lot of very important clinical facts.
Thanks, Jeff. I can't wait.
I'd like to add a couple of parenthetical comments or thoughts to the eloquent discussion by Dr. Hayes for those who are thinking about male hormone-related dysfunctions, because we've been focusing exclusively here on female neuroendocrine imbalances, and I just want to make sure we do a sidebar to take a stop along the road indicating that there is a correlation and an interesting similarity with some of the things that we see in male-related problems, the difference being obviously the relative balance of the players, the dancers in the dance, whereas women have traditionally higher levels of the estrogenic hormone messages and men lower level of the estrogenic metabolism. Women have low levels of the androgens, and men have high levels of the androgens. So it's kind of the teeter-totter is tipped in a slightly different way. You have women high estrogen, low androgen. You have men high androgen, low estrogen. So it's basically just the same story recast in a different way. Now, the reason I bring that up is that they have a very remarkable adverse effect when imbalanced either way on function. And I'm reminded of that when I think about the difference in structure between a testosterone molecule, I'm talking about the chemical structure, and an estrogen molecule. The difference between testosterone and estradiol is just the removal of two hydrogen atoms from the A ring of the testosterone molecule. A dehydrogenase enzyme just plucks off two hydrogen atoms, and now we've taken a maleness hormone and we've converted it physiochemically into a femaleness hormone. So very small perturbations in structure can lead to remarkable changes in function, very small changes in concentration of any one of those players as to how they're playing their dance part can play remarkable different roles in the outcome of the dance. And so with males, if there is inappropriate metabolism of their estrogens, even though they're in small concentration in their body, they can have profound influences on their function. And we now see literature saying that prostate cancer may be a condition associated with inappropriate metabolism of estrogen in the male prostate gland, and that prostatitis may be the formation of these irritant estrogens, like the 4-hydroxyestrogens in the male prostate gland. For some of you males listening to this, you probably are feeling like this is fingernails on the chalkboard because you don't want to associate estrogen with your own reproductive hormones. But it's a very important part, even though in small concentrations, small differences in the personality or the levels of these estrogens in males can have profound differences on influence, just as small differences in testosterone or androgens in females can have profound differences in their function. So I think that what Dr. Hayes is talking about in balance, we should be mindful of in male neuroendocrine function, just as we are focusing here on the female function. Dr. Hayes has left us with a number of thoughts, obviously many more than we could follow up on in the second side of this month's Functional Medicine Update, but I'd like to at least try to do a few things in filling in the gaps from many of the questions and concepts that she raised, and obviously our symposium, the 8th International Symposium on Functional Medicine, will continue to develop some of these themes even more fully. Let's first talk around the topic of hot flushes, because many women arrive at the concerns of their hormones related to symptoms. The symptoms that may be most aggravating are these hot flashes or hot flushes that are seen with reasonable prevalence in the Western world as women go into the perimenopausal period. Hot flushes or flashes occur frequently, as Dr. Hayes has pointed out, during perimenopause, and it's considered a very frequent side effect of the climacterium. They appear in women after bilateral surgical oophorectomy or medical gonadectomy as well. However, flushes also appear in women undergoing medical or surgical operations related to the hypothalamus and pituitary. Approximately 40 to 50% of patients who are well into natural menopause suffer from hot flashes. So let's say about half of the women suffer from this vasomotor reactive symptomatology. About 80% are likely to suffer from flushes for a year or more, and about 30% will perceive the symptom as being unsupportable and need to really do something about it because it's so compromising quality of life. As Dr. Hayes very beautifully pointed out, the evidence would indicate that these are not a consequence of what have been traditionally thought of as low estrogen symptoms, but rather the changing estrogen from the highs that are often seen, which could be very high, even higher than that during pre-perimenopausal, to the lows, and that can occur these transitions over the course of but a very short period of time. And it's the delta, the change in estrogen, that seems to drive the appearance of hot flushes. So it's a symptom associated with changing estrogen balance from very high levels to very low levels very rapidly. And the more the delta T, the more the change in estrogen, the more there is a potential for the symptomatology. So it's a question of estrogen imbalance and its correlation with progesterone and estrogen metabolites. This was beautifully pointed out in an article in Obstetrical and Gynecological Surveys in Obstetrics and Gynecology back in July of 1989. We also recognize that these highs and lows of estrogen then stimulate the degranulation of cells and have effects upon both catecholamines, histamine, and serotonergic receptor sites. And therefore, when we start seeing rapid changes in estrogen levels in the perimenopause that occur in the matter of a very short period of time, that it actually causes what we might call a symphonic catastrophe. It's as if the orchestra that was once orchestrated to play beautifully with the synchronization of all the sections of the orchestra now starts to kind of do a sit-down strike and play at their own meters and each musician doing their own thing, and that creates quite a noisy symphony that doesn't sound very pleasing. And that's an analogy to what happens during this period of time where there is a very rapid rise and fall in estrogen levels, and other hormones are equally, therefore, in lack of synchrony, including the serotonergic and dopaminergic hormones. This is pointed out in Acta Physiologica Hungarica, Volume 84, page 183 in 1996, that this can lead to the degranulation of mast cells producing histamine, and you start getting various vasomotor reactions when you have these hormonal imbalances occurring. The estrogen receptor and its immunoreactivity is related in part to the signaling of these neuroendocrine-like symptoms and may have something to do then with the presence of the vasomotor symptoms of perimenopause. What we can say, however, is that the rate of change of estrogen levels maps itself against the rate of change of other neuroendocrine active hormones, and that translates in part into the alteration in mast cell degranulation and histamine release. So certainly, by balancing estrogen, as Dr. Hayes has so nicely talked about, we have a much improved control over the orchestration of these various hormones with less chaos and less white cell or immune cell reactivity. Dr. Hayes also talked about the role that dehydroepiandrosterone, or DHEA, replacement therapy might have in women who have certain types of hormonal imbalance associated with either perimenopause or menopause. And it's interesting to note that the period of perimenopause, although not too many years in length, maybe only 4 to 5 years at most in length, may be the period at which there is the greatest amount of bone loss and the greatest amount of need for hormone replacement therapy for precursor hormones like dehydroepiandrosterone. Dehydroepiandrosterone and its sulfate, as we know, are precursors to many of the androgenic hormones, and ultimately those then get converted by aromatase peripherally into estrogen. So there is a relationship between DHEA replacement therapy and the control or the functional levels of all of the sex steroid hormones. So when we start asking the question, does DHEA play a role in menopause or in perimenopause, the answer appears to be yes from some clinical studies that I think started to identify the interrelationship. One of these studies, which was recently published, is in the journal Steroids, volume 63, page 322 in 1998, entitled DHEA and the Endocrine Formation of Androgens and Estrogens in Peripheral Target Tissues, Its Role During Aging. And in this article, they point out that DHEA in the ovaries may help stimulate testosterone formation and androstenedione, but peripherally then that is converted into estrogens via the aromatase enzyme, which is the central principal enzyme involved with the conversion of androgens to estrogens. So you get what appears to be effects at producing balance of estrogen, testosterone, and ovarian levels, and then you also get estrogenic effects peripherally. Now, as Dr. Hayes pointed out, what happens if the woman is already shifted in their ovary, in the theca cell, towards excess testosterone, which is often the case with hyperinsulinism and insulin resistance? If a woman has too much insulin as a consequence of insulin resistance, and knowing that about 20% of the non-diabetic population apparently has differing degrees of insulin resistance, according to Dr. Gerald Reaven, then in that case, DHEA supplementation could actually create a greater impact upon testosterone and exacerbate the imbalance. So a DHEA therapy is really, I think, one that wants to use with some degree of sobriety and understanding of the insulin balance and insulin sensitivity. However, there are some very positive roles, apparently, for its use. For instance, how about dysthymia and dysphoric syndrome in perimenopause? In a randomized double-blind crossover trial using DHEA in women with midlife dysthymia and dysphoric syndrome, it was found that 90 milligrams of DHEA led to a significant improvement in both those conditions. This was reported in Biological Psychiatry, Volume 45, page 1533 in 1999, suggesting that the effects of normalizing androgens in women had positive influence also on brain function. So we get the ovarian testosterone, we get the peripheral aromatase conversion to estrogen, and we have then a salutary effect on hormone balance, according to the study. I should emphasize that 90 milligrams a day of DHEA is a supraphysiological dose and therefore could have influence upon adrenal gland function. Remember, a lot of the DHEA that's synthesized is coming from the adrenal glands in postmenopausal women, almost all of it. And as a consequence, if you then give too high a level of DHEA, you may suppress an adrenal gland steroidogenesis. That's always the watchword when you're using hormone replacement, but particularly as we talk about supraphysiological doses of DHEA. The normal adrenal gland will produce about 30 milligrams of DHEA in a day, and therefore this would be considered a dose that was in excess of what would be normally produced and could cause adrenal suppression. Another interesting example in a clinical trial of DHEA in neuroendocrine effects of menopause appeared in the journal Maturitis in volume 28, page 251 in 1998. In this particular study, they used for short term 100 milligrams a day of DHEA in postmenopausal women against a placebo and looked at beta endorphin levels and the effect it has on the hypothalamus pituitary axis and found very salutary effects with normalized beta endorphin and improve physical well-being. This tracks against the study that was published on women who were suffering from fatigue and low libido and just a general sense of compromised well-being, who were given 50 milligrams of DHEA daily and were found to have improved sexual interest, libido, and a feeling of well-being. And these were women who were presumed to be having the symptoms of running out of gas, GAS, General Adaptation Syndrome, the Cellier model of stress, going through arousal, adaptation, and exhaustion. So these were the women somewhere between adaptation and exhaustion starting to fall off the edge for whom DHEA supplementation appeared to be desirable. By the way, this level was closer to physiological replacement doses at 50 milligrams dose. We also have seen an interesting paper appear recently on the effect of DHEA supplementation. This is another 50 milligram per day supplementation group on women who had various types of depressive disorders, and this is postmenopausal depression, and contrasted it to fluoxetine, a SSRI drug, and found that there was very favorable influence on depression as contrasted to a comparison with an SSRI at the 50 milligram per day level. This is a study done in Italy, published in Gynecology and Endocrinology, Volume 13, page 15 in 1999. We've also seen DHEA supplementation having a positive benefit on ovarian function in menstruating women. These are women who have been having difficulty getting pregnant. They may be candidates for in vitro fertilization. And in a study of 80 milligram per day oral micronized DHEA for 2 months, it was found that in these women there was improved response to ovarian stimulation even after controlling for gonadotropin dose, and therefore supplemental DHEA during ovarian stimulation may represent a novel way to maximize ovarian response, showing again the power that DHEA has in its ability to serve as a precursor to both the androgenic and estrogenic hormones. We know that there is circadian rhythms, obviously, of DHEA use, and therefore, as Dr. Hayes pointed out, single analysis may not give us as much information as doing multiple analyses of salivary DHEA so that we can look at the periodicity or the circadian nature of it. A recent paper looking at cortisol DHEA ratios was a very interesting paper because they then did a baseline of cortisol to DHEA in the saliva, then gave a single oral administration of DHEA. This is an elderly individual, and the dose they used was a 50 milligram dose, more near a physiological replacement dose. And the data demonstrate that the circadian rhythm of DHEA is totally abolished in elderly subjects and that this single 50 milligram dose restored the circadian rhythmicity of hormones and almost completely normalized the 24-hour profile of the cortisol to DHEA molar ratio without affecting the cortisol cyclical rhythm. So again, replacement in individuals who have low DHEAs, who have this tiredness, fatigue, sleep disturbances, low energy, low libido profile may be called for, but once again, we talk about making sure that the female patients are not shifted towards hyperinsulinemia. By the way, the previous paper I just mentioned appeared in Metabolism, Volume 49, page 548 in the year 2000. We also know, as I said, that during perimenopause, there's a considerable increase in bone loss, and so the question has been asked, does DHEA supplementation help to protect bone? And there are a few clinical studies in this area. One is in actually anorexic women who are non-menstruating as a consequence of anorexia nervosa, and they were then administered oral DHEA to graded doses of 50, 100, and 200 milligrams daily against a placebo, had various bone density measurements done, including DEXA analysis and hydroxyproline in the urine evaluated, and it was found that the 50 milligram dose was adequate and well-tolerated and appeared to normalize bone turnover in women who had anorexia nervosa with low estrogen drive. Although this is not exactly the same as perimenopause, the model suggestion is that in these endocrine imbalances that DHEA appears to have a salutary effect on bone. So what we're really saying is that there is certainly evidence from the human intervention trial literature to indicate the value of DHEA replacement in women with hormonal imbalances, particularly if their estrogen shifted and they're not able to produce adequate levels of the estrogen hormones, and that in the stress-modulated dysfunctions with low libido and low energy, that DHEA might prove useful, but one should grade the dose and be cautious about producing androgenic symptoms in the women, such as acne or unusual bleeding if they're still menstruating, or changes in body composition, because if you get into the hyperinsulinemic state or into the hyperandrogenic state, then you start to enhance visceral adipose tissue accumulation. So clearly, the women who may have difficulties with glucose intolerance and insulin resistance are those that we want to be very cautious with, according to Dr. Hayes, and there's some beautiful data that's been published recently that confirms that. We know that menopausal status itself does not necessarily alter insulin sensitivity. That was published in Diabetes Care, Volume 23, page 801. But there are women who go through this perimenopause-menopause transition who have incipient and then becomes fully realized insulin resistance hyperinsulinemia, for whom the menopausal status does influence their relative balance between androgens and estrogens because of their hyperinsulinemia. We know that the effect of transdermal estrogen replacement therapy has some influence on hyperandrogenicity and glucose homeostasis in postmenopausal women with non-insulin dependent diabetes, once again confirming that there is this correlation between estrogens and insulin and its interrelationship then to androgens. So we exacerbate some of the problem that is seen with insulin resistance and hyperandrogenicity, and that by reestablishing proper balance of hormones, that this has an effect on insulin management as well as on estrogen testosterone balance. This, by the way, was a paper that was published in the Archives of Obstetrics and Gynecology in Scandinavia, Vol. 78, page 260 in 1999, that talks about the effect of estrogen replacement therapy on hyperandrogenicity and glucose homeostasis. We know that there's a differential effect of transdermal estrogen plus progestogen replacement on insulin metabolism in postmenopausal women. And so one might say, well, gee whiz, if you give estrogen with progesterone, you'll get a different effect than if you give equine mixed conjugated estrogens with synthetic progestogens. So what are we really speaking to here? In this one study, which is in the European Journal of Endocrinology, was found that transdermal estrogen substitution alone and combined with cyclical synthetic progesterone or progestogen may ameliorate hyperinsulinemia in those individuals who have insulin resistance. So the combination of a progesterone derivative plus conjugated estrogens did help improve insulin sensitivity. This is volume 140, pages 215 in the year 1999. We also know that as a woman is shifted in her hormones towards the androgen imbalance and having lower estrogen secretion, that there is also a shift during these periods of times with altered pro-inflammatory cytokine generation. And this obviously comes out of the modified gene expression patterns and occurred with these hormonal imbalances. The period at which this is most obvious in the clinical pattern of the woman is at perimenopause, where the estrogen levels are varying dramatically, as was described earlier, and the difference between highs and lows can occur very quickly. In those cases, there is a very significant alteration in white blood cell elaboration of pro-inflammatory substances, including the cytokines, like tumor necrosis factor alpha and interleukin-1 and interleukin-2. This is in part described in an article that appeared in Free Radical Research Communications, Volume 14, page 195. And in this particular paper, the group talks about the fact that estrogen at high levels induces the enhancement of activity of human polymorphonuclear leukocytes and increases in the release of various inflammatory mediating substances. Well, this is seen clinically very frequently, and certainly most clinicians dealing with women that are going through perimenopause that have the symptoms of hormonal imbalance, such as the breast tenderness and the difficult periods and the hot flushes during the day and the evening, that they would also say, yes, these women often experience joint pains. They may have fibromyalgia-like symptoms. They may have just generalized arthralgias. And that is, in fact, a result of these altering gene expression patterns of some of these inflammatory mediators. hormone replacement therapy has been identified to improve the balance of these inflammatory and anti-inflammatory mediators, as well as it balances hormones, the sex steroid hormones. And it works principally in women who have hyperinsulinemia and insulin resistance. And therefore, women who show a lot of inflammatory reactions during the perimenopause with all these other symptomatologies occurring that are associated with the highs and lows of estrogen changing quickly, that these women are also amenable through the appropriate hormone balancing therapy to lower their C-reactive protein and other inflammatory cytokines, which then lowers the sense of arthralgias, myalgias, arthritis-like symptoms. By the way, this was described very nicely in a recent paper in The Lancet, volume 354, page 47, in which the title of the paper is Hormone Replacement Therapy and Sensitive C-Reactive Protein Concentrations in Women with Insulin Resistance and Hyperinsulinemia. And it was found that using a combination of estrogens and progesterones in this particular group significantly reduced C-reactive protein concentrations in these postmenopausal women who had the hyperinsulinemia, insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes profile. So if you're clinically managing women who have a complex array of symptomatologies ranging from breast tenderness to difficult periods, menorrhagia, to problems as it relates to shifts towards hirsutism, or let's call it androgen shifts with facial hair and visceral adipose tissue accumulation with increasing waist-to-hip ratios and low energy and low libido and hot flushes. Am I describing any woman that you might have ever come in contact with? I think there are those who carry all these symptoms and also has these inflammatory-like symptoms of myalgias and arthralgias. That those are all woven together through this combination of insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, and estrogen testosterone imbalances. And therefore, by intervening with a balancing program, which is where the fulcrum of this balance beam lies, many of these things will improve. However, you need to simultaneously be attending to the management of the insulin resistance. So it's a combination of both insulin resistance management and hormone balancing therapies. When I say hormone balancing, I mean the sex steroid hormones. Now, what do we do in terms of the insulin balancing or insulin managing or sensitizing approach? And this has been a topic, obviously, that we've discussed at length in Functional Medicine Update over the last several years, the use of lipoic acid, N-acetylcysteine, chromium, vanadium, various fibers, herbs such as gymnema, looking at the way that we can lower the glycemic index of the diet to lower the glucose load, the insulin response. All of these are themes that we have described in previous issues of Functional Medicine Update that are applicable to this kind of a woman who has the insulin imbalance situation that is exacerbating her sex steroid hormone imbalance, and then realizing all these gene expression marker molecules, these mediators that contribute to the symptoms that she sees that seem so wide-ranging across many organ systems. So it's like, you know, how many different medications does she need to treat all these symptoms? And the answer is she just needs to balance the beam of insulin sensitivity and hormone metabolism. Very interesting concept. We also then start talking about, what about hormone replacement therapy? Aren't we concerned about increasing mitogenic drive on certain tissues and raising the risk to cancer? As you know, there's an ongoing debate in the literature as to whether estrogen causes breast cancer, and we started off thinking that estrogen replacement therapy protected the heart and protected the various organs, including the reproductive organs of the woman, and now we're starting to recognize that some of these early studies were not all that we were led to believe, and that there are some questions about what cohort of women might be responders and what non-responders, and maybe some that are positive responders are offset by those that are adverse responders. Early studies by a variety of investigators using hormone replacement therapy suggested that estrogen, usually conjugated equine estrogens is what they call estrogens in these studies, did not increase the risk of breast cancer. But more recently, this premise has been called into question. Both epidemiological studies, as ones described in a January year 2000 issue of JAMA, which we discussed last year in Functional Medicine Update, an article by Scheer et al., suggested that combined hormone replacement, most often conjugated equine estrogens and synthetic progestogen, medroxyprogesterone acetate, Depo-Provera, did increase the risk of breast cancer slightly, and more interestingly, that medroxyprogesterone acetate increased the risk over estrogen alone, which was kind of counter what had been previously said. Determining whether hormone replacement therapy is safe in the postmenopausal woman has centered largely on increasing the information base, trying to do more studies to learn more. Unfortunately, much of the data used to decide that HRT was safe came from studies of the endometrium, although the risk of endometrial cancer is much greater with the use of estrogens. Producing high levels of hyperplasia and atypia in less than 2 to 4 years of time in most studies, the risk was thought to be completely countered by the addition of either progesterone or the much more powerful synthetic progestins such as medroxyprogesterone acetate. Because of this and the fact that endometrial tissue is more readily accessible for study, and this is because obviously the number of hysterectomies allows this tissue to be available for study, assumptions were made about estrogen-sensitive tissues other than the endometrium, specifically the breast, on the basis of kind of inferential information obtained from the function of estrogen and progesterone in the endometrium. Many of these assumptions over the last year, 2000 and moving into 2001, have been proven unreliable when applied to breast tissue. First, the endometrium, as you know, contains much higher numbers of estrogen and progesterone receptors, perhaps explaining why endometrial cancers are seen much more rapidly with hormone replacement therapy. Secondly, the levels of estrogen and estrogen metabolism in two organs are modified by the storage and metabolism of estrogens in fat. Thirdly, the presence of estrogen receptors and progesterone receptors throughout the menstrual cycle is different in breast and endometrium, suggesting these cyclicity and circadian rhythms are different and the responses to exogenous hormones might be different. So we have a lot of variables going on simultaneously, each interacting with themselves, and this is what Dr. Hayes has so eloquently pointed out to us. It is clear that the turnover of breast epithelial tissues with the menstrual cycle, that the amount of tissue which grows, differentiates, and involutes in the breast is nowhere near the volume of tissue which turns over in the endometrium. However, we should be very assured that the metabolic function of the breast tissues, which is different than that of the endometrium, may play an important role. As the ovaries lose their function, the breast may still be very responsive to these altered hormone levels that a woman has throughout perimenopause and going into menopause. So I think we can say that there is a very wide-ranging level of concern about how various hormones are modified and how the message is received within the breast after menopause, and therefore hormone replacement therapy, whose safety was built principally around looking at the endometrium, may be less so when we start looking at specific tissues like the breast. There is a relationship we know also with environmental xenoestrogens. And the xenoestrogens further compound this problem, the dioxins and other chlorinated hydrocarbons, which react with the various estrogen receptors and may have also effect upon the estrogen detoxification mechanisms. So we see a relationship between genetic damage from things like polycyclical aromatic hydrocarbons in breast that are confounders. We've often heard these referred to as endocrine disruptors, a term that Dr. Theo Coburn applied to these materials. I'm now quoting from an article that appeared in Carcinogenesis, Volume 21, page 1281, in the year 2000, that gets us to think about confounding variables that may, in certain genetically susceptible women who are exposed to certain environmental xenohormones, induce increasing risk and damage. We also know that certain drugs that are used as supposedly breast preventive agents, like tamoxifen itself, may produce adducts in the endometrium and adducts within different DNA that increases risk to specific cell proliferative disorders. I'm now quoting again from Carcinogenesis, Volume 21, page 1461 in the year 2000, which describes DNA tamoxifen adducts in the endometrium of women that were treated with tamoxifen, suggesting that there could be frameshift mutations and or carcinogenesis induced. So the story is, you know, a little bit more complicated, and as you probably saw recently, it's been suggested that maybe women ought to be put on synthetic progesterone when they're taking tamoxifen to lower the risk to endometrial lesions and endometrial cancer. And a real interesting debate about that, as well as a kind of a counterbalancing effect to tamoxifen-induced DNA damage in the endometrium. This is The Lancet, Volume 356, page 1698, that discusses this tamoxifen-related endometrial lesions and the prevention using a synthetic progestogen intrauterine system to release 20 micrograms of progestogen to the uterine cavity so as to counteract the adverse effects of tamoxifen. Wow, this story gets complicated, doesn't it? We're really playing with most sophisticated orchestration. I mean, we're really dabbling in an orchestration that we really only know the first melody line of. We don't know the harmonies and the syncopations and all the texturing, and sometimes going in and horsing around with a melody line, thinking we know the whole orchestration, that ruins the whole composition. We don't really understand enough to know what we don't know. And I think that's part of the worry that we have right now, the confounding variables of estrogenic effects of chemicals, the confounding variables of genetic polymorphisms of estrogen detoxification and the conversion of various metabolites, like the 4-hydroxyestrogens and the 16-hydroxyestrogens that are different from woman to woman, the interrelationship of insulin with progesterone and testosterone and estrogen balance, the effects that different progestogens have on differing tissues and the cyclical and rhythmical nature of these that vary throughout the cycle or the time, and how that differs between the endometrium and the breast. Wow. These are very, very important issues, obviously. If a woman expects to live in her body for half of her life without menstruation, these are different questions than women have ever asked about their body, and it's a very, very important part of the decision-making. So what about the safety, usefulness, and availability of transdermal natural progesterone cream? Some of you know that in the 1980s, Dr. Katarina Dalton in England published a series of letters in the medical literature indicating that one of the predominant forms of PMS or PMT associated with water retention and bloating, painful breasts, and mood swings was a result of progesterone insufficiencies. She published a number of papers over the early years of 1980 through about 1988 on this. She advocated the application of cyclical vaginal progesterone cream to manage this condition and emphasized that natural micronized progesterone cream was the compound of choice as contrasted to the use of synthetic progestins. The medical community at this time raised significant concern over this therapy in that vaginal progesterone is very rapidly absorbed and could cause adverse symptoms and potential side effects. In the 1990s, Dr. John Lee, all we know of him as an incredible pioneer in this field and a physician in Northern California, published information suggesting that natural progesterone cream could be safely applied to the skin of the forearms and was therefore useful in managing hormonal problems in premenstrual, perimenopausal, and postmenopausal women. Dr. Lee reported that natural progesterone cream, when applied daily to the forearms of postmenopausal women, could also result in increased bone density. This was published in the 1990 issue of The Lancet in November, as well as his 1998 paper in September of The Lancet on page 905. He proposed that natural progesterone is a missing link for many women in the prevention of postmenopausal bone loss and osteoporosis. This was a paper that he authored in Medical Hypothesis in 1991. Dr. Lee's advocacy for the transdermal use of natural progesterone cream created tremendous interest within both the medical and women's health consumers groups for the development of a better understanding of the safety and effectiveness of this compound. In 1998, Stevenson and Purdy reported that transdermal progesterone cream did not cause an elevation of serum progesterone, and therefore the best thing that could be said about it was it had no adverse effect. And I'm now quoting from their paper in The Lancet. They cautioned that women should not rely upon progesterone cream to protect them against postmenopausal bone loss. McFarland responded to the Stevenson and Purdy letter in The Lancet, saying that they did not measure the correct parameters, nor did they ask women in their study how they felt when they were administered progesterone, because maybe even though the plasma levels were low, the response clinically was high, which he felt it was, obviously. It was McFarland's contention that if they would have asked whether there was a subjective improvement in these women, they would have found that the women stated that they felt better after they administered the progesterone cream. Cooper and his colleagues also challenged whether progesterone cream was absorbed across the skin at a level that could have any beneficial effects in a companion paper that appeared in The Lancet, April 25, 1998, page 1255. Elia, McClure, and Ferrat commented that natural progesterone is absorbed across the skin at levels that one needs to be concerned about overdosing it if applied too frequently. So this is the other side of the story, suggesting that, yes, it is absorbed, and it can be absorbed at a level that if excessively applied could cause problems. And this has been confirmed by a number of other clinicians who have seen women come in with sky-high progesterone levels as a consequence of over-administration of transdermal progesterone or progesterone cream. This was published in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine in the spring of 1998. A detailed study by a highly regarded medical school gynecologist, Dr. Hermesmeyer, and his colleagues at the Oregon Health Sciences University on the absorption of progesterone cream seemed to resolve this controversy in that this group found that the application of transdermal progesterone cream at the correct dosage appeared to be a safe and effective route of administration. This was published in American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, June of 1999. This is page 1504. In this study, postmenopausal women were administered progesterone cream on the forearm containing 30 milligrams per day of natural progesterone, so the dose was graded and quantified. They reported significant increases in serum concentrations of progesterone in all the women studied, and this was a very well-controlled study done by a very highly regarded leader in the field of gynecology. Leonetti, Longo, and Anasti at the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at St. Luke's Hospital in Pennsylvania studied 102 women randomly assigned within 5 years of menopause to transdermal progesterone cream or placebo. A complete hormone evaluation of the women was done, including thyroid hormones, follicle-stimulating hormone, lipid profiles, and estrogen-progesterone ratios. Subjects were instructed to apply a quarter of a teaspoon of the cream containing, in this case, 20 milligrams of progesterone to the skin of the forearm daily. Bone scans and serum chemistries were repeated after 1 year. 30 of 43 women, or 69% in the treatment group, and 26 of 47, or 55% in the placebo group, complained initially of emotional symptoms before the administration of progesterone. So they were, you know, within experimental error about the same. Improvement or resolution of the emotional symptoms as determined by the review of weekly symptoms chart was noted in 83% of those women who had the progesterone cream and only 19% of those who had the placebo trial cream. And therefore, the statistical significance is greater than P01 between these two groups. There was no change in bone mineral density between the progesterone group and the placebo group in the study, and they concluded that although they found no protective effect on bone density of progesterone, they did see significant improvements in emotional symptoms in the treated group. This is Obstetrics and Gynecology, August of 1999, page 225. The Harvard Woman's Health Watch newsletter in 1999 reported that, quote, "There is scant evidence for the use of progesterone cream," end quote, and recommended that women not use this therapy until it had been subjected to more rigorous randomized clinical controlled trials. This was the October issue of the Harvard Woman's Health Letter in 1999. Recently, Carrie Patil Carter and Studd from the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Chelsea and Westminster Hospital in England have reported on a dose-response study in women who had administered progesterone cream to their forearms. This is the British Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, June of 2000, page 722. They studied 24 healthy postmenopausal women who were randomly allocated to progesterone cream, that was now 40 milligrams per day or 20 milligrams twice daily. They measured follicle-stimulating hormone, estradiol, testosterone, progesterone, and its metabolite pregnenediol-3-glucuronide. They found a rise in the mean progesterone concentration in the blood. There was no change in follicle-stimulating hormone, estradiol, or testosterone levels after the progesterone cream. They conclude that transdermal progesterone cream at the level of 40 milligrams per day caused a small but measurable increase in blood levels of progesterone without altering the level of other hormones. These data suggest across these studies that there is some absorption, that the dose range from 20 to 40 milligrams does seem to produce symptom improvement. There is no significant impact upon other hormones in these studies. It doesn't seem to have a very dramatic effect in suppressing hypothalamus or pituitary function, and that there's still a problematic question about whether it does or does not improve bone density when administered by cream to the skin of the forearm. It is known that progesterone excess can create imbalances in other hormones that can result in adverse clinical outcomes. Acute administration of natural progesterone when administered as a vaginal cream has been found to increase peripheral resistance by decreasing blood flow in extremities and may therefore attenuate the beneficial effects of estrogen therapy in postmenopausal women. This was a report in the American Journal of Cardiology, July of 1999, on page 214. However, in order to do that, you need to get a very high dose of progesterone, which generally would not be achieved as a consequence of cutaneous application at the doses that we're talking about. Taken as a whole, what can we say? These articles indicate that progesterone cream at the dose of 20 to 40 milligrams per day is absorbed into the blood, although at low levels, and can have clinical effects in improving mood in women with progesterone insufficiency. It seems to reduce premenopausal and perimenopausal symptoms such as bloating and breast tenderness and help balance estrogen influences. It can also be concluded that progesterone cream does not reduce the risk of bone loss, at least it hasn't been identified at these doses, in postmenopausal women. The safety of this administration appears to be reasonably low from the literature provided, but again, we haven't done complete circadian rhythm studies on breast tissue. We haven't looked at the effect of insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, on the metabolism of progesterone and its balance with estrogen, nor have long-term trials been done. But it's important to recognize that if there's a reasonably short period of time that it's going to be used for symptom management and improvement, and that hormone analyses and clinical symptoms are being closely followed with vaginal cytology, that, in fact, natural progesterone cream may, in fact, be a very useful tool in forming the kind of balances that we're describing in this discussion of what to do during this perimenopause and menopausal period. I think, lastly, it's very important to point out that the nature of how these hormones are balanced will depend to some great extent on how they are metabolized, their secondary metabolic fate. We have discussed only briefly the role that these hormones have as it pertains to their metabolic downstream contributors, which include the 16-hydroxyestrone or estradiol, which is more estrogenic than estradiol or estrone itself and has a higher mitogenic drive on cell replication and cell cycling. We also have not talked much about the conversion to the 4-hydroxyestrogens, which are unoxidized by redox recycling into the 4-hydroxycatechols, which then go on to further be converted by oxidation into the quinones. The quinone estrogens of the 4-hydroxy family are highly genotoxic and react with DNA very rapidly, and the only way they can be detoxified is through glutathione conjugation. The glutathione conjugation is dependent, therefore, on adequate availability of glutathione and adequate levels of activity of the enzyme glutathione transferase. We know that glutathione transferase in men and women is a polymorphic enzyme. It exists in different isoforms, and some people are not able to do as effective a glutathione conjugation as others. So what happens if a woman is taking acetaminophen, which is known to deplete glutathione, and drinking alcohol and under high stress, and now she is also on equine estrogens, which are known to facilitate higher 4-hydroxyestrogen conversion. And so now she starts having breast tenderness and pain, and we're not sure exactly where this is coming from, and we think, well, maybe she needs more progesterone. But the effect may be in part resulting from the conversion of these toxic estrogens by downstream metabolism. And she may have to balance this with the appropriate nutrients necessary to focus on 2-hydroxylation. 2-hydroxyestrone and 2-hydroxyestradiol are often called the, quote, good estrogens, end quote. I want to get away from this good-bad terminology because it's often misused in that it's balance that really is the key. But because women are often shifted towards the 4 and 16 hydroxylation patterns away from the 2, then we often say improving the 2-hydroxylation will have a desirable effect. It turns out that environmental xenoestrogens shift detoxification of estrogens towards the 16-hydroxyestrogens, things like TCDD, dioxins, will shift estrogen detox towards the 16 mitogenic superestrogens and away from the 2-hydroxylation. It's also known that the methoxylation, or the methyl transfer to 2-hydroxyestrogens, produces 2-methoxyestradiol and 2-methoxyestrone. These particular byproducts of estrogen metabolism, now having gone through phase 1 hydroxylation at the 2 position of the steroid nucleus and then methoxylation to produce the 2-methoxy compounds, are actually anti-carcinogens, anti-mitogenic, and have a salutary beneficial effect on modulating overall estrogen metabolism. So it's a feedback-controlled, kind of harmonically damped process that is actually setting up the proper rhythm, the proper dance of these molecules. So if a woman is shifted in her metabolism towards the 16 and the 4-hydroxyestrogens, then she is shifted away from the favorable 2-hydroxylated estrogens, and she is more in a mitogenically driven situation with higher DNA turnover, higher cell replication, and more risk then to various types of estrogen-driven problems, including that of the breast and the endometrium. Well, if we look at what to do about that, you probably know detoxification plays an important role. Second, we know that there are certain phytonutrients, particularly indole-3-carbinol, I3C, derived from cruciferous vegetables, and its companion product, dienoyl methane, which is a downstream metabolite of indole-3-carbinol. Indole-3-carbinol has been shown in many clinical human trials to be very important for improving estrogen metabolism and enhancing 2-hydroxylation at the expense of lowering 16-hydroxylation. It's also recognized that indole-3-carbinol in clinical trials led to a reversion in preclinical or precancerous lesions of the cervix, and this is a histology study and done in women, at doses of about 300 milligrams a day. That would be equivalent to what a woman would get from 2 to 3 portion sizes of cruciferous vegetables that were in a good form that hadn't been denatured by cruel and unusual punishment of overcooking. And it's also known that the 4-hydroxyestrogens, these caustic estrogens I talked about, can be blocked in part by the appropriate redox agents, generally things like curcuminoids, soy isoflavones, limonene, which is a plant monoterpene from citrus, and lastly, the green tea catechin-gallo compounds, the gallate compounds, epigallo-catechin-gallate, ECGC, which are known to block the redox recycling to these quinone-like derivatives that cause DNA damage. So there are many things a woman can do if she's shifted in her metabolism towards these in vivo toxic estrogens or in situ toxic estrogens. And I think that's the takeaway from the story. Balance, balance, balance. Don't just intervene at first level with hormone replacement. First get a woman to be balanced by improving her metabolism and trying to manage insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, try to give her proper redox coupling with the curcuminoids and the ECGCs and the limonene, and try to then shift her to hydroxylation as a preferential pathway with proper methoxylation by using things like indole-3-carbinol. A very powerful story, and I hope another chapter on an evolving understanding of functional endocrinology. We'll see you at the symposium in May. Thank you.
Time is getting short. May 22nd through 26th marks the dates for the Institute of Functional Medicine's 8th International Symposium on Functional Medicine, this year held in beautiful Vancouver, British Columbia. Year after year, IFM hosts the meeting that consistently showcases researchers and clinicians who influence the course of medicine. You'll be spending 4 exciting and challenging days learning about functional medicine approaches to endocrine disturbances of aging from world-renowned presenters and researchers in that field. To review the exceptional topics and speakers at this year's symposium, please visit www.fxmed.com or call IFM Client Services at 1-800-228-0622 for your free brochure. Be sure to ask about the pre-conference course entitled Applied Biochemistry and Nutritional Endocrinology, perfect for newcomers or experienced functional medicine practitioners who want to keep up to date on nutrition and biochemistry. So don't forget, mark your calendars and submit your registration forms, because space is filling up quickly. This completes the April 2001 Functional Medicine Update. Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by the Institute for Functional Medicine, located in Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.